Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney. And welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. You know, it's somewhat comical to watch the press shift from loyal lapdogs and palace scribes to the empress-in-waiting Hillary Clinton back into rabid attack dogs foaming at the mouth and attacking every act of President-elect Donald Trump, even making up acts when the outrage meter isn't cranked up far enough for them. The latest faux horror is a Muslim registry where Trump will supposedly require all Muslims in the U.S. to be cataloged and then placed under surveillance. Well, wrong. That is not the case, nor should it or would it ever be the case. But when the point is demagoguery and political propaganda, our media and the left have zero compunction about lying and misleading the American public. So they're doing their unhinged best to paint the nascent Trump administration as a bunch of jackbooted Nazi thugs saying, "Your papers, please," to anyone looking at all Muslimy. You know, I said it was comical, but really, these attacks on the new administration are dangerous because they take common sense measures and slime them with vile slurs like racist and Islamophobic. If we allow them to be successful in this, they actually make all of us less safe. So we are forced time and time again to stand athwart the stream of spittle-flecked craziness yelling, "Stop!" Now, what is actually being proposed is a return to the use of a Bush-era tool called National Security Entry-Exit Registration System. This is a system that says if you come from areas where there is a large preponderance of enemies of the United States, you get extra scrutiny when you come here. That's it. It is imposed only on non-citizens who wish to visit the U.S. on a non-immigrant visa. So no late-night knocks on doors of Muslim families to randomly round them up for questioning. No warrantless surveillance based only on religion. Nothing more than taking a good look at those who come from places our enemies dominate. Now, it's worth pointing out that entry to the United States is a privilege, not a right. Those who want to come here have the obligation to prove to us they deserve it. We don't have to prove they don't. Under existing U.S. law, the president has the authority to ban entry by anyone, anytime, for any reason. That authority has been used by the last six presidents in some way to keep the country safe. The law also says that members of any totalitarian group which advocates overthrow of the U.S. government or the Constitution can be banned outright. Now, there are plenty of Islamic supremacists who openly admit they want to install Sharia law worldwide. Those people have no business being given any opportunity to come here and try that garbage. We wrote a policy paper on that, which you can find if you Google Center for Security Policy and Stop Importing Jihadists. As Frank says, we don't need any more. We've got plenty. Now, what is painful is the idea that this is in any way controversial. It's not an attack on all Muslims. It's an attack on those who contemplate an attack on our very way of life, our freedoms, and even our lives. We owe them nothing. And keeping an eye on those who want to come here from areas controlled by people like that is simply a minimum level of due diligence by our government. Now, this was starkly and painfully demonstrated by the fact that a number of the 9/11 jihadist scum were here on visas that they overstayed. We saw how that turned out. We currently still have no systematic way to track those who come here on a tourist or student visa and simply don't leave. It was painful to watch official after official of the Obama administration testifying that they have absolutely no clue how many people have overstayed their visas, and worse yet, really no interest in finding out. And it's not much better for those who apply to come here as immigrants or refugees. The female San Bernardino terrorist came on a spouse visa, and even a cursory look at her background and the false information on her application should have stopped her entry or at least flagged her for a closer look. Instead, she got waved right through, and 14 people died and 22 more were wounded. Now, as far as refugees, there is a desire in all decent people to help those affected by war and the barbarities of groups like ISIS. But that doesn't mean the answer should be, well, let's bring them all here. That makes no sense. And as the FBI director has said, we have absolutely no way to tell the innocents from the jihadists because there are no records in Syria to check them against. You cannot vet people by asking them, excuse me, if we let you come here, are you going to be slaughtering any infidels in the name of Allah? Somehow I think that will fall short of a decent standard of vetting. And again, there is no right to come here, so perhaps we should be focused on helping these people where they are. For the cost of relocating one refugee to the United States, we can help a dozen in the region. That makes a heck of a lot more sense to me. So let me be clear. None of this is about singling out Muslims for unfair or unconstitutional scrutiny. It's not even about U.S. Muslims at all. It's about making sure that before we let anyone into this country, we ensure to the best of our ability and within the laws we have established that they aren't a threat. And those very laws contemplate forbidding entry to anyone with an interest in threatening our freedoms for any reason, whether ordained by their God or whatever. You are not invited. And if you come from an area where large numbers of your co-inhabitants share this desire, then we have every right to keep a weather eye on you if we decide to even allow you to come here. You should be thankful you got the opportunity, not whinging because you may have to answer a few questions. This is not a case where, as Ben Franklin warned, they that can give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. This is a case where protecting those essential liberties requires looking at how our safety may be affected by allowing those who don't share our values to come here. I, for one, expect President Trump to do just that, to place the safety and security of all Americans above some non-existent right of anyone else to come to these shores. And even more so, I expect him to look at our entire broken immigration system and far too open borders and do something to fix that. Somehow I feel there's a pretty good chance of that happening. Now, this will certainly generate howls of outrage from the usual suspects, but we must stand up for the new president, the country, and our fellow citizens, Muslims included, against threats from all enemies, foreign and domestic. If you want to catch more of this and my shorter and pithier opinions, you can find me on Twitter. My handle there is Uncle Jimbo. Up next after the break, we're going to be talking to the Center for Security Policy's Fred Flights. He has been watching the Iranian nuclear program since his days back at CIA and has kept a serious eye on the shortcomings of the Iran deal and how it has made us all less safe. We'll be back with Fred and more Secure Freedom Radio after the break.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined now by Fred Flights, Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy. Fred's a former CIA analyst, served as Chief of Staff for Ambassador John Bolton, and also a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. He also wrote the new book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. We will get to the dangers and the national security nightmare posed by the Iran deal. But first, Fred, there's a lot of speculation today that Lieutenant General Flynn might be President-elect Trump's pick for national security advisor. What do you think about that possibility?
Oh, it's good to be a general. It would be a fabulous pick. Given his military service, his work in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the fearlessness he has shown in his work for the Obama administration. And what I mean is they let him go because he was talking about radical Islam, something the administration didn't want to talk about. He's just the perfect person, I think, to speak truth to power and to put together a national security strategy that addresses the real threats facing our nation.
I didn't know him as a military officer until when he was running the intelligence operations in Afghanistan. He wrote a scathing report about how badly it was being done, how the hamstringing of the gathering, how the politicization of the analysis and all the rest of it was basically causing us to fly blind, and then put that out publicly. And this was quite a while ago and was a bold move for a senior military officer in a very politicized environment. So I think you're absolutely right. He has no fear of giving his opinion and telling people this absolutely does not work, and also has good ideas about how to make it work. So I'm with you on that one.
I might add that CIA was very angry at him for that report, and they complained to the Pentagon, but he cleared it through the Pentagon. He had permission to write this report, and it was an instance, again, trying to speak truth to power.
Yeah, he was right. He had the advantage of being right about how bad it was and how it was hampering the war effort and getting our troops killed. So it may have hurt some feelings, but I am much more comfortable with hurt feelings than hurt soldiers. So good on him, and let's hope that those reports are correct and that President-elect Trump makes him the national security advisor. Let's shift gears to your book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, which people can get on Amazon, and I highly recommend that you do, because whatever you think about the Iran deal, you don't know how bad it was. You just absolutely cannot know how bad it was. And however bad you think it is, if you think you know, it's worse. So, Fred, let's talk about the potential for a President Trump after January 20th to do something about this. If you had his ear and could give him advice, which you've been doing about the Iran deal since it surfaced as a bad idea, what would you tell him to do first right now?
Well, I had the privilege to discuss this issue with two of the center's region groups in Los Angeles and Dallas this week. And I told both of them that the situation on the Iran deal significantly changed. We now can either substantially revise or kill this terrible deal. And what I say in my book, Obama Bomb, and I also said in the recent National Review article, we have to recognize three things about the agreement. First of all, that it's a fraud that doesn't really stop the Iran nuclear program and has made Iranian behavior worse. Second of all, it is not binding because it's not a treaty. Now, the administration has claimed that, well, since the Security Council endorsed it, it is binding. Sorry, you can't go around the Constitution with the United Nations. And finally, it's not really multilateral. That's another argument being made. Well, you know, the Europeans are parties, it's the Chinese and the Russians. So we can't back out of it. Yes, we can. It's really a bilateral agreement. These other nations are just along for the ride. It was almost entirely negotiated in secret by the U.S. and Iran for all these reasons, for the fact that it subverts the Constitution and it's fraud. At a minimum, it has to be substantially renegotiated. And frankly, we should consider just getting rid of it.
Okay, well, now let's take those piece by piece. You say it does not actually stop the Iranian nuclear program. Now, obviously, that would be the only reason to do this deal. But what about it allows them a clear path to build and own and become a nuclear power?
Well, it was supposed to stop the threat from Iran's nuclear program, but the agreement has enormous flaws. First of all, inspections to verify it don't include military facilities, and that's where the secret nuclear weapons work will take place. Iran is allowed to continue to develop its expertise in weapon making because it will be allowed to enrich uranium with over 5,000 centrifuges while the deal is in effect. Also, although Iran temporarily disabled a heavy water reactor, it's being rebuilt by the Chinese. This reactor will produce plutonium, which can be used in nuclear weapons. And the rebuild of this reactor has been exempted from an oversight process to make sure that there's no diversion of technology for weapons purposes. I mean, I could go on and on, but I mean, the fact that this doesn't legitimately stop Iran's nuclear weapons program, I think there's simply no doubt of that.
So it would seem then that getting a deal was more important to the Obama administration than getting a deal that actually did what it says it does. This seems to be a fig leaf over the fact that they were unable to negotiate a deal that took away the very capabilities that we need to take away from a rogue nation like Iran. The idea that they would not even inspect military facilities is absurd. That's where everyone who has been watching this, yourself included, knows that their most vital pieces of this program have been operating.
That's right. Jay Solomon, in his new book, The Iran Wars, documents how time after time after time, whenever there was a point of contention, we caved. And I also talked about that in my book. The reason is this administration desperately wanted a deal, any deal. They wanted to do the victory lap. They didn't care what was in the agreement. And I think the reason, there's several reasons for this. I mean, I think that Obama, at the end of the day, thought that Iran can't be stopped from getting a nuclear weapon. And this agreement will somehow make Iran our ally. We can live with an Iranian nuclear bomb, and Iran's behavior will improve after it gets this agreement and sanctions are dropped. I think that thinking was absolutely wrong-headed, and we've seen since then with Iran's behavior getting worse, the president was absolutely wrong.
And that's the part, because I think you're right, and I just cannot fathom how someone who has been a sentient being since 1979 could take the behavior of the Iranian regime and make that assumption, let alone someone who has been president since 2009 and who has watched what they've done during that time period. I mean, their behavior during the Iraq war, when they were providing explosively formed projectiles and arming and helping the Shia militias kill U.S. troops, to all the other provocations and all the other things they've done, should lead anyone to consider them not a partner for peace, but an enemy and a problem for anyone who wanted peace. And yet he made these crazy assumptions which have not been borne out. Is there any good news in their behavior since then? I mean, has any of his fantasy world come to reality?
No, it's so much worse than we could have thought. And I might add that part of these talks on the nuclear deal included talks on the sidelines to enlist Iran as an ally in Iraq and Syria. Right after the deal, what did Iran do? It sent troops into Syria. It's more involved in Syria and Iraq than it was before the agreement. This is deeply destabilizing because it drives Sunni support to ISIS, and it's basically propping up the Assad regime. This deal is a disaster on so many levels.
Well, Fred, I think we're going to have to dig into that a little deeper, because we managed to get through point one of the fact that none of the things this deal was supposed to do have actually were, first of all, included in the deal, and second of all, none of them have come to fruition. Even the minor things that it was supposed to do, all of it has gone backwards. We're talking with the Center for Security Policy's Fred Flights. We'll be back after the break with more Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We are back with more Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank Gaffney, and we're talking with Fred Flights, one of the foremost followers, unfortunately, of the Iran deal. And Fred, I wish you had something better to spend your time watching, but you've been extremely diligent in keeping an eye on what the Iranians are doing, what the administration's doing, and how the entire debacle that they call the Iran deal doesn't actually exist. Now, in the previous segment, we talked about how the deal as negotiated doesn't really even stop the Iranian nuclear program in any meaningful way. Let's talk now about the second point you made, which is that the deal isn't actually binding on really anyone. I mean, us, them, the international community, anyone. Tell us a little bit about why this is not a binding deal at all.
Well, our founding fathers intended long-term international agreements that were legally binding on the United States to be ratified by the Senate. That takes a two-thirds vote. Now, the president deliberately did not submit this as a treaty to be ratified by the Senate because he knew he couldn't get the two-thirds vote. So he implemented this as an executive agreement. And the problem with that is that the next president can throw it out, and they simply don't have they don't have the authority aside from the legal weight of a binding agreement. And they try to go around this by having the Security Council endorsing it. And since Security Council resolutions are supposed to be binding, they can argue that the Trump administration can't back out of the agreement without the Security Council's permission. Sorry, that's not the way our system works, and the UN Charter does not trump U.S. Constitution.
You know, the fun thing about that term is going to be in play for the next 4 years for sure. And I think Donald Trump is going to trump President Obama's attempt to end run the U.S. Senate. He knew there was no chance this deal was going through the Senate. And it was a popular opinion by the time they finally found out as much as they found out before he declared victory, put it at 22% of the American public approved this. So he knew it was a dead deal. He tried to do an end run around the Constitution, and he failed. Okay, he managed to get the deal into the headlines, which was his main concern. He's more of a campaigner and a politician than a leader. So, okay, he's got the headline saying, you know, historic Iran deal, Iran will no longer be a threat to anyone ever, except to, you know, all the people in the region who they're definitely a threat to. But what do we do now? Now, we're sitting here. We've got a new president coming in. We've got a Republican majority in the Senate still. Does President Trump submit the Iran deal to them and let them go ahead and say no to it? Is that the best plan, or does he just rip it up?
Well, the first thing I think has to be done, and I can see this is already being done, and the center is trying to help, is to make the case that this is a bad deal, because there are Republicans trying to back away. The National Iranian American Council put out a report that was signed by 76 experts. They're claiming they're bipartisan, but if you look at the four or five Republicans, they're not really Republicans, saying that Trump can't back out of the deal.
And let's be clear, the National Iranian American Council is an Iranian tool. So there's nothing there.
It's known as the Iranian lobby in the United States. So what a surprise. They opposed Trump's nomination and candidacy, and now they're telling Trump he can't back out of the Iran deal. So it's sort of silly. But there's some Republicans who say that he can't either, and these are mostly Republicans who didn't support Trump anyway. The Trump organization has to confirm he's going to do this, and that's what they're doing. Wally Ferris said very clearly over the weekend, the deal will be dismantled. So that's the first point. I think we need a tough president and a tough secretary of state who organize a new alliance with Europe and Israel and Saudi Arabia. We shouldn't have negotiated an agreement on their national security behind their backs that they opposed. They had no idea what was going to be in this agreement, and they were furious. So were the Gulf states. They have to be involved in the dialogue on a new agreement. the process to pressure Iran has to start with cutting off all transfers of nuclear technology until it answers questions about its nuclear weapons-related work and stops activities related to nuclear weapons. That has to start. We're not going to stop the program that way. We're not going to hurt their economy by doing that, but we can delay and hopefully significantly delay any weapons-related work. And there has to be other sanctions related to terrorism, its interference in the region, its threats to American shipping, firing missiles at U.S. ships and other ships in the region. There's a lot to do. This starts with a tough president, which we will have, and a tough and decisive Secretary of State.
Okay, Fred, we're looking then at renegotiating the deal and trying to actually do the things President Obama said he wanted to do and failed miserably and did not accomplish. You make a valid point. The folks in the region, the Saudis and the other Gulf Arab states, were not consulted, and they tried to buy them off with arms, you know, for them after they give the Iranians a clear path to nukes. Kind of a bad idea. So we add them to some sort of multilateral negotiating team. We take a new run at this. We negotiate a new deal. Then we're assuming President Trump submits that to the Senate.
Well, I hope there's a new agreement. Since Iran may not be party to it, it simply may be a new sanctions regime. And that's going to basically cut off trade, cut off sales of aircraft, severe sanctions on any banks that do business with Iran. And that some of that would be implemented through legislation because Congress had to pass it. Some of it could be done by the president. I think everything should be done with Congress's support. So the world knows that this isn't just the White House talking. That was President Obama's mistake. He did too much stuff by executive order, not just in the foreign policy field. Legitimate policies have to have support from both sides of the aisle, and I'm hoping that's what Mr. Trump will do.
And so I guess that makes sense, because I you know, hate to be skeptical, but I think pragmatism requires that we assume the Iranians are going to fail to come to what would be a reasonable agreement. I mean, they got away with it under Obama. Now they have been readmitted to the community of nations. You know, they've got their banking freed up. They got pretty much everything they wanted out of the deal without giving up their nuclear program. So I have great respect for President-elect Trump's deal-making ability, but I think it's fair to say that's a pretty steep hill to climb. So your point then is this may turn back into a unilateral or unilateral and multilateral from our side, minus the Iranians, reinstatement of the kind of the stick it took to get them to the negotiating table in the first place. And we might have to go through that process again before we can get to anything resembling a deal they would be involved with.
I mean, those are all good points. And people who've heard me say this, they've said, well, Iran will never join this agreement. Or if Trump tries to renegotiate, Iran will cancel the whole thing. Well, first of all, the deal is meaningless in the first place.
So what?
That's not a good argument.
Right.
And so basically, Iran is cheating. But what concerns me is that this deal, the way it's structured, it legitimizes Iran's nuclear program and is allowing it to develop an industrial-scale nuclear weapons program. So anything is better than this. And remember one time when Obama said, no deal is better than a bad deal? Well, that was subtly changed to a bad deal is better than no deal. He never said that, but that's clearly what we got. And I think we have to say, look, no deal is better than a bad deal. Cut off transfers of nuclear technology at a minimum, and we'll go from there.
Is there a way potentially to go ahead? Because my fear is that the Saudis have already bought a bomb from Pakistan or North Korea or somebody else and, you know, either have it or are taking delivery. And is there any way to include them, if we're going to make multilateral agreements, to have them as part of that and potentially try to stop proliferation from the other Gulf states who fear Iran?
I don't think talks on an agreement is going to have the Saudis and Israelis sitting at the table. First of all, I don't think they'll sit with each other. But they have to be part of the consultative process to bring about the agreement. And I would include other Gulf states, because this concerns them most of all. They're in the region. They're the ones who are likely to be hit by an Iranian nuclear weapon first, if it's ever fired. And, I mean, they're very concerned about Iran's missile program. These missiles aren't being developed to fire monkeys into space. They're being developed to carry nuclear warheads, and their first targets are in the region.
Well, all of that makes perfect sense to me. Thank you, Fred, for being a clear and informative voice on one of the more dangerous agreements made in our lifetimes. Fred Flight, Senior Vice President of Policy and Programs from the Center of Security Policy. This is Jim Hansen. We'll be back after the break with more Secure Freedom Radio, talking to Dr. Peter Pham about Africa.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We are talking now with Dr. Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. Now, Peter, we want to talk and have been about some of the challenges that are going to be facing the new president. And you've written about why President Trump should make Africa a foreign policy priority. Now, I am aware of many challenges and many difficulties and many strategic interest the U.S. has in Africa, but what specifically do you think should put that up near the top of his list?
At the top of the list is security. Securing our future, the world's future, and its safety from the type of jihadist terrorism, the type of Islamist militancy. If the primary fight is currently in Syria and Iraq against the so-called Islamic State, the second front is really Africa, where it has its largest presence outside of Iraq and Syria. Groups in Libya, and increasingly in the Sahel region of Africa, and into Nigeria, where Boko Haram, a year and a half ago, pledged its allegiance to the so-called Islamic State, and where we now, I was just there last week with a delegation. We were literally at the edge of the Zambeza Forest, in northeastern Nigeria, and what we're seeing is more than half of the fighters now in Boko Haram aren't even Nigerians. They're foreigners. So this is the newest front. So the security angle is a big one on the terrorism angle, but it's also security against other rising powers. China's established the first Chinese overseas military base anywhere in the world, and where they put it? In Djibouti, in the strategic Horn of Africa region. But there's also opportunity, and this is important for America as well. Opportunities in terms, some of the world's fastest growing economies are in Africa. Africa holds some of the world's key strategic minerals, 95% of the platinum, 90% of the chromite, and on and on. And so there are also great opportunities there as well for the U.S.
Let's start then with some of the Islamist threat. And obviously there have been operations against ISIS in Iraq and Syria that in some ways are going well. They're going badly for ISIS. Whether they're going well for the, you know, the folks who live in Anbar is an open question, because a lot of them seem to be taking collateral damage from the Shia militias. But the ISIS folks have displaced a large number of their people, some of their leadership, and Libya and other places in Africa are obviously, as you mentioned, a growing situation for them. You've got the other major groups, Boko Haram, and there are plenty of others. Do you think there's a trans-African caliphate that could potentially emerge from this?
The danger is there, and we have to be vigilant for it. Right now, these groups are acting somewhat autonomous, but there's clearly coordination where they're being squeezed in Libya. We're seeing the fighters and the weapons showing up in across the Sahara and Nigeria. So they are interlinked, and that's important to keep in mind. You know, unfortunately, a number of analysts have repeatedly gotten this wrong. I remember just 5 years ago when Congress held its first hearing on Boko Haram, I testified at that hearing, and it was the distinct minority view that this was a serious terrorist organization that should be designated a terrorist organization. Clearly today, no one disagrees with that, but just, in the twinkle of an eye, it has changed, but we could have seen that change coming and perhaps nipped it in the bud.
Now, there are others too. The Sudan has some Islamist groups and has often seen itself as the place that will unite Shia and Sunni Islam to become, you know, the one united Islam. Are they still as active down there in that kind of ignoble goal?
Sudan probably is, one could say, it's certainly far from what we would like or ideal, but it's certainly come a long way. Hassan al-Turabi, the granddaddy of global jihadism and the man who attempted to unify it all in the early 90s, has passed away in Sudan. Actually, today is participating in its broken diplomatic relations with Iran, and is actually taking part in the Sunni coalition fighting Iranian proxies in Yemen. So there's been a change. I'm not ready to, if you will, fully exonerate them, but I one has to acknowledge that they've given considerable cooperation also to our efforts, clandestine efforts in Libya. So whether that change of heart is brought about by self-interest, fear, or some combination thereof, in this fight, we'll take it where we can get it.
Yeah, no, that was, they had some pretty bold goals, and none of them were in our interest, so that's good to hear. Let's shift. We're talking with Dr. Peter Pham about why Africa should be a major strategic push for President Trump. The other area you mentioned was minerals and strategic elements of, you know, Africa's natural resources. Now, China has made over the past decades a fairly strong push to insinuate itself both into petroleum and especially into some of the heavy metals and other things, as you mentioned, that are vital for national security and for high-tech manufacturing. Is that something that we're in a position now with the great deal maker as president to potentially be a counterbalance to?
I very much hope so, because we've too long kind of looked at, you know, written off the Chinese or discounted the nature. And Communist China is playing a long game. It's not, they're willing to take losses in the short term for a long term access to these natural resources and to political influence throughout the continent. It's telling that China deploys more peacekeepers to Africa, and well, maybe that deserves to be in quotation marks, than the other four permanent members of the Security Council put together. And they're not doing it necessarily out of a good global citizenship, but because of a long-term strategic play. As I mentioned earlier, Jim, it's telling that in all of its years of its existence, the People's Republic of China has never had a foreign military base, and last year, they began constructing one, and where do they put it? Right in Djibouti, not far from the largest U.S. base in Africa at Camp Le Moyne. Their base straddles the important Bab el Mandab, which separates Africa from the Arabian Peninsula, key strategic hub leading up to the Suez Canal, and gives them access to a wide swath of the Western Indian Ocean as well.
And that, I think, is worth noting, because, you know, the Chinese have been highly active in the Pacific Rim, their backyard. They've been, you know, creating islands to make into military bases. They've been claiming maritime rights and air rights and a lot of other stuff. Obviously, they can't be that, you know, straightforward in their militaristic endeavors in Africa. But the idea of a permanent base there, the idea that they would be going in and out, that should concern us. And that should lead us at least to want to put some effort into making friends in places where the Chinese are well ahead of us.
Very much so. And I'd add also, we have to be careful what we ask for, too. 8 years ago, in its last days in office, the Bush administration made the mistake, I think, of asking the Chinese to help with anti-piracy operations, and they quickly said yes. And since then, using that as a pretext, China has constantly deployed a task force of at least three warships at any time off the east coast of Africa, supposedly to deter piracy. But it also gave them a excuse that since we asked them, we can't now turn around and tell them to go away, to develop what they didn't have before, which was a long-range expeditionary capability for their Navy. So the key is be careful what we ask for, because a short-term gain may be a long-term gain for them.
Dr. Peter Pham, thank you so much. We will hope that the president-elect and his national security team listen to your sober and good advice. That's going to finish up Secure Freedom Radio for today. This is Jim Hansen. We will be back tomorrow with more ammunition in the fight for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.